From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Cutting, squeezing, trimming, and spending. Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point. President Trump wants to cut government except for Social Security and Medicare. At the same time, he wants to put people to work. So a new infrastructure program might appeal to the Democrats, but Republicans say the money's not there without cutting those sacred entitlements. As Trump begins work on a so-called skinny budget, he finds himself bound by vague campaign promises that may turn out to be contradictory. And don't forget major cuts for wealthy taxpayers. We'll look at early efforts at assembling a financial puzzle, even when the pieces don't seem to fit. On our talking point later, covering the White House, when the media is the enemy. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Donald Trump may be a rare new breed of president, but he's faced with problems that are all too familiar. We'll hear about his first efforts at putting together a budget and keeping his promises all at the same time. Today's talking point, Saturday, the president said he's at running war with the news media, but his press secretary still has to deal with reporters every day. We'll hear the latest round in a long-running battle. First, his news update. President Trump has thumbed his nose at environmentalists today and the Obama administration as well, with executive orders to go ahead with controversial pipelines bringing oil across the Canadian border. First up, the Keystone XL pipeline.
We're going to renegotiate some of the terms, and if they'd like, we'll see if we can get that pipeline built. A lot of jobs, 28,000 jobs.
Another order would advance the Dakota Access Pipeline, the recent subject of massive protests involving environmentalists and Native Americans. Amy Harder is energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
The White House has made some statements. We heard one of them. You, as I understand it, have now found the texts involved. What more do they tell us?
Right. I'm looking at them right now, making sure that we've got all the important tidbits. I would note that out of the five actions that the president took today, all but one of them are actually presidential memorandums, which carry with them slightly less force than an actual executive order. So there's one executive order, and then the rest are presidential memorandums ordering certain agencies to take certain actions, i.e. expedite the final review of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and then also on Keystone, expedite a review for that project, assuming, of course, that the company behind the project, TransCanada, reapplies for the permit at the State Department.
We heard the president say renegotiate. He's got to have a negotiating partner.
Right, exactly. And we just heard in the White House press briefing now, spokesman Sean Spicer talk about how, you know, Mr. Trump as a businessman likes to renegotiate deals. That concept isn't really reflected in the text of these presidential memorandums. It's more simply stating some of the technical processes at hand regarding these pipelines, both Dakota Access and Keystone, and then calling for an expedited review. But again, I'm just looking through the text now, and I anticipate we'll all have more information in the coming hours and days.
With regard to the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Army Corps of Engineers indicated that it was ceasing the project for the moment, saying that more environmental review had to be done. Is there anything that reflects that or suggests that the Army Corps of Engineers changed its mind?
Right. Well, the order essentially calls on the Army Corps, or excuse me, the memorandum calls on the Army Corps to expedite the process, the review process, to approve that last part. There isn't, from what I can tell at this point, any reference to what the prior administration has done. And what, you know, what Obama did toward the end of his presidency was quite rare for an administration to stop an approval like that. So I think Trump is trying to reverse that. And I anticipate the Dakota Access Builder and Energy Transfer's partners to finish construction on that pipeline relatively soon because it's mostly built. That said, the Native American tribe at issue here has already vowed to sue on behalf of this action today.
I believe it was Spicer who's been reported as saying, the press secretary who's been reported as saying, that we're going to use materials that are made in the U.S. What's that about, and how much of a change would that require?
Yeah, well, that, just looking at the text right here in front of me, it calls on the Secretary of the Commerce Department to write up a plan to call on pipelines to, quote, use materials and equipment produced in the United States to the maximum extent possible and to the extent permitted by law. So this isn't a hard and fast law that all pipelines have to be made with U.S. steel, but it's certainly a strong signal to the business community that this is what the president wants. And, you know, we've seen in the last several weeks the new president isn't afraid to use his powers of Twitter and others to call out companies he's not happy with. So I don't think this has legal impact, but it certainly will have a strong symbolic influence in the business community. I should note, though, that President Trump, as a businessman himself, the Wall Street Journal has reported, didn't use a lot of U.S. steel himself in his buildings.
What steel has gone into the pipeline so far? Do we even know?
I mean, I don't know the details of where they came, but TransCanada, for example, with the Keystone XL pipeline, used a lot of imported steel. It's generally something that companies use because it's often cheaper than U.S.-made goods. I think we've seen that in the broader trade debate, and I think you're seeing here, again, the president trying to maximize and follow through on his campaign promises to put America first. We'll see how the business community reacts with this. So far, I think they're acting cautious, cautiously, in part because they're generally benefiting from today's actions.
Okay. I don't think we have time to go into it, but once again, the president mentioned 28,000 jobs. Figures like that are always up to controversy, and we'll see if that one is too. Amy Harder, it's great to talk with you, energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
In a moment, cutting, squeezing, trimming, and spending on To The Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. President Trump has promised to cut government spending at the same time he cuts taxes on the wealthy and finances an infrastructure program twice as big as the one proposed by Hillary Clinton. The process is beginning with what's called a skinny budget that Trump hopes to deliver in 45 days. Alexander Bolton broke the story for The Hill. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What's a skinny budget?
Well, the skinny budget is the preliminary budget that the new administration sends up to The Hill. Because this is a new administration, they've had less time to work on it. I mean, it's not like the Obama administration, they'd have the previous year to work on the budget for next fiscal year. Trump just took the oath of office on Friday. His transition team has been working only for a few weeks. So the preliminary budget is essentially the summary tables, the top line numbers that get sent to Congress, but doesn't have the accompanying analysis and the addendums and the rescission packages that the big fat full budget has. That's not coming to the Hill until about 90 days. And so skinny budget comes in within the next 45 days, at least that's tradition. The bigger fat budget comes within the next 90 to 100 days.
One of the top line numbers I've seen is $10 billion over 10 years. Where does that come from? $10 trillion. I beg your pardon.
Well, $10 trillion over 10 years, I mean, that is in the Heritage Blueprint for Balance, the Heritage Foundation's Blueprint for Balance. And the two guys on the Trump transition team, two former aides to Mike Pence, the vice president, they are the guys at OMB working with a career official to try to find some savings, to try to lower those top-line numbers, and they are working off the Heritage budget. Now, that's the foundation where they both worked. You know, Pence, when he was on the Hill, I mean, he was a revolutionary budget cutter. He would get into trouble with the Republican leadership when he was a young conservative up here, as did Paul Ryan. Actually, Paul Ryan, the speaker, was reminiscing at the luncheon on Friday. You know, he's telling Pence, I remember when the two of us used to get hauled into the speaker's office together and yelled at. So the Heritage Blueprint is what they're working off of to, cut the discretionary spending. Now, the Heritage Blueprint altogether includes reforms to Medicare and Social Security. I mean, that's where the big savings come from. Now, that's where the $10.5 trillion over 10 years comes from. Now, it remains to be seen whether Donald Trump will endorse those cuts to Medicare and Social Security. As you know, he campaigned against them, but that decision hasn't been made yet. The guy who's going to have a major voice in all this, Mick Mulvaney, the nominee to serve as a director of OMB, I mean, he hasn't been confirmed yet. He just had his hearing yesterday. So we'll see just how far Trump goes. But at least at the preliminary level, the staffers from the Trump transition team working with the budget office, they're looking to get rid of some of these smaller programs that conservatives, going back to Ronald Reagan, have been trying to cut for years.
And the OMB is the Office of Management and Budget. That's an office that's in the White House. Is that correct?
It's the White House Budget Office.
Okay. So you say they're looking at smaller programs. Here's what Mr. Spicer, the White House press secretary, had to say yesterday about in response to a reporter's question about that.
We've got to look at how we're spending the American people's tax money. And so what the work that the landing teams have been doing is going into these agencies and departments and talking about ways that we can create greater efficiencies, eliminate duplicity, and maximize the tax dollar.
Now back to Alexander Bolton. You say they're looking for smaller programs. Things that get mentioned are the programs for public broadcasting and support for the arts, which are, if I may, a spit in the ocean by comparison to what we're really talking about here. Where do they appear to be looking for significant cuts that would really make a difference outside Medicare and Social Security?
Well, I mean, you have to remember this is early on in the process. And so, you know, the big money, as we know, it's Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. I mean, those are the big programs. Those are also the big decisions, and those are going to be made at the summit level, further down the road. At this point, you know, I mean, the administration is only a couple days old, so they're hunting for the smaller game that people on the landing teams, you know, have the authority to handle. And so what they're looking at are things that have been, you know, hunted, slated for elimination in the past. I mean, the ones that have gotten the most attention, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I mean, the proposal is to privatize that. Also, eliminate National Endowment of the Arts, National Endowment of the Humanities. This is something that we saw 12 years ago after the Republican Revolution of 1994. That's when Newt Gingrich and his band of revolutionaries came in. They also tried to cut these programs. So these are things that have been on the chopping block for a long time. You know, the difference is, for the first time in a long time, 10 years, going back to 2006, this is the first time Republicans control the whole government. So they're taking another shot, you know, at programs that, you know, they have long wanted to get rid of. And, you know, some other things on there, Legal Services Corporation, that's something that Reagan tried to get rid of in 1981. That's something that's in the Heritage Blueprint. It's also in the Republican Study Committee budget proposal for 2017. The Republican Study Committee budgets have been supported in the past by Paul Ryan, the Speaker, and by Mick Mulvaney, the White House Budget Director in Waiting, if he's confirmed by the Senate.
Okay, Alexander Bolton, once again, the staff reporter at The Hill. Jared Bernstein is with us. You've been on the other side of all of this. You were an aide to Vice President Biden for a while, now senior fellow at the Center on Budget and on Budget and Policy Priorities, author, too, of The Reconnection Agenda, a Reuniting Growth and Prosperity. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks a lot.
How many little programs like the Legal Services Corporation, which primarily serves the poor, public broadcasting, the Endowment for the Arts, how many programs like that is it going to take to make the kinds of cuts that Donald Trump has promised and that the others have promised, $10 trillion over 10 years?
About a billion of those programs. We're talking about a tiny drop in the ocean. The spending cuts that are on the table in the Heritage budget you're talking about, as you've mentioned, amount to $10.5 trillion. So let's talk about the National Endowment for the Arts. Okay, the appropriations for that are about $150 million with an M. So that's million with an M, trillion with a T. And if you take the percent, you're talking about 0.01% of the spending cut. So that's purely symbolic. That's not saying that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting or the National Endowment for the Arts are the best programs. There are some that think they're fine. There are some that think they're terrible. They have absolutely nothing to do with achieving any kind of spending parity, as is the alleged goal of this budget. And I think the critical point here, and it's one that you've already kind of been dancing around, is that the following math is patently impossible. You cannot preserve Social Security and Medicare untouched, increase defense spending, significantly cut taxes, balance the budget within any kind of budget window at all, certainly within 5 or 10 years. The arithmetic to do that it is just completely implausible. It can't work. So either you give up on the goal of not touching the entitlement programs, that is, this is really a process that ends up with significant cuts to Medicare and Social Security, which, by the way, are in that Heritage budget, or you give up on the kind of fiscal rectitude you're advertising for yourself.
Let me introduce Peter Morici. He's a professor at the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. He's a former chief economist at the business-oriented U.S. International Trade Commission, sympathetic to the Trump administration. Peter Morici, it's always good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be with you. I'd say I'm sympathetic. The International Trade Commission is an independent federal.
I meant you, and not the.
Not to impugn those my former colleagues, many of whom are probably good Democrats like Jared.
All right. The question becomes then: did Donald Trump simply make a set of promises that are incompatible and can't be reconciled?
Well, I mean, the federal government spends $4 trillion a year. To cut $1 trillion. Even with dynamic scoring for a tax cut and all the rest of that business, you're not going to do it. You can't increase. I agree with Jared's basic premise. Now, can you cut entitlements and discretionary spending without breaking trust of people? There are places where there's waste and there's places where there's abuse. I'll give you a good example. The Social Security disability system. 1 out of 20 adults is on disability. That's an absurd number in this day and age. I mean, it used to be much, much lower, and we're healthier these days. There's a lot of abuse there that even, public broadcasting has shown a light on in the appeals process and so forth. There's apparently some fraud that needs to be fixed.
Maybe you need public broadcasting to make sure everybody knows about them.
Well, the point is what I'm getting at, it wasn't something cooked up by Fox News, okay? The other thing is that there are things that we probably shouldn't be doing that we do. For example, even if you're a fan of Obamacare, I'll give you that for just a moment, okay, suspend disbelief. I don't know that we should be using Medicaid to provide free health care to men between 25 and 54, there's 7 million of them, who don't look for work and don't work. They just refuse to be active in the labor force. I don't know if we should be giving them food stamps and Medicaid. That's why those programs are set up. They were set up for children and mothers and so forth initially. So there are places where you can trim while you still take care of the needy that you was always spoken about taking care of. Then, of course, you get into stuff that's more aggressive, and that, you know, you do really start to see the ideological fissures open up, like doing block grants to for Medicaid to the states under the notion that they can manage it better than the federal government. My feeling is a lot of this stuff boils down to the Republicans really don't want to bite some hard bullets.
Isn't that what they would be doing with block grants to the states? Wouldn't they be saying, we can't do it, so you do it?
So all they're doing is passing the bullet from the president to the governor to bite, or from the Congress to the state legislatures. And in fact, only the Congress has the ability to do some of the things that need to be done there. For example, addressing the fact that we pay so much more for drugs and medical devices than the Europeans, and that our hospitals have so much more bureaucracy. You know, people that were uninsured before Obamacare were getting on planes and going to Amsterdam. And Holland is not necessarily known as a hub of efficiency. And even with the hotel stays for their wives or their husbands, getting a knee replacement over there was just a lot cheaper, paying the market rate, not the insurance rate, because the people over there are insured. But what they charge foreigners, it was very cost efficient to do that. We need to address things like that.
Okay, now, let me go back to Jared Bernstein. When we start to address things like that, presuming we do, and that the Congress gets involved with it, are we talking about adding up to enough to try to make the kinds of cuts that have been promised without messing around with the major parts of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, even if you mess with the disability issue and the Medicaid for young men?
Yeah, not even close. Just the arithmetic, once again, simply doesn't work out. Now, that's not saying that there aren't places to cut. Of course there are. Just like there are in any business, there are places in government where we could certainly find some savings. By the way, they tend to be far more tricky and controversial than we make them sound on these kinds of shows. President Obama actually consistently had cuts in Medicare, okay, so the retirement health care program, amounting to north of $400 billion. And he had those in his budgets for most of his tenure. I know because I was with the administration there. Not only did Congress refuse, the Republican Congress refused to look at the budget, they pilloried him for suggesting those cuts. So when a lot of these men and women go back to their districts and start talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare, if they do, they're not well received. And I think the premise of our conversation is kind of skewed, because we almost have this sort of embedded assumption that, you know, we really need to cut the entitlements, or we really need to cut spending very significantly. Well, that's not an assumption that everybody wakes up with in the morning. I mean, it's really easy to say that in a broad sweep, but let's talk particulars. I mean, do we really want to damage people's access to Medicare or their Social Security? Do we really want to whack away at safety net programs that help low-income people like Medicaid or SNAP? And by the way, let me correct something that I think may be misunderstood here. When you block grant a program, that is, when you turn this program over to the states, what you're typically doing, let's say Medicaid, is you're making it no longer an entitlement that can expand with need and contract when you don't need it. What you're doing is you're giving the states a fixed block grant, a fixed amount of money.
So you put a lid on it.
They put a lid on it. They're going to have to figure out how to squeeze the program into that. And what that ultimately does, it ends up, and we can see this in a program called TANF that was block granted. What that ultimately does is that these programs stop growing with inflation or population growth, and they stop serving the needs that they were intended to serve.
Okay, hang on to that. We're going to have to take a break. Sorry to interrupt you, but we are required to do that. We'll continue this conversation when we are done with the break. And our talking point, we'll talk about covering the White House when the media is the enemy. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren, only back with To The Point. So far in this program, we've been talking about cutting that President Trump wants to do, cuts in programs going all the way back to Ronald Reagan. And how can you do that without cutting Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid, which are programs so popular that the Republicans wouldn't let President Obama cut them? Now, here is Donald Trump from his inaugural address talking about the spending he wants to do.
We will build new roads and highways and bridges and airports and tunnels and railways all across our wonderful nation. We will get our people off of welfare and back to work, rebuilding our country with American hands and American labor.
Russell Berman is with us, senior associate editor with The Atlantic. He covers national politics. Always good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Where's the money supposed to come for that?
Well, that's unclear unless they're willing to raise taxes. And, of course, President Trump has said he wants a massive tax cut for corporations and individuals.
Has he been detailed at all, more than we have heard just now, about the kind of infrastructure planning he's doing and the kind of projects he wants to build to keep all those American hands and American labor busy?
Well, that's a good question, because we haven't heard a whole lot of specifics from the new Trump administration on infrastructure. Actually, Sean Spicer was asked yesterday in his first official briefing if the issue had fallen off of the top priority list, and he said it had not. But we haven't heard nearly as much from certainly Republican congressional leaders about that, and that's because there's a lot of skepticism, if not outright opposition, among Republicans in Congress to a big spending infrastructure plan.
Okay, so what's happening today? We heard earlier about Mike Mulvaney, who's going to be or who has been appointed to be the head of the Office of Management and Budget, which is in charge of putting all these numbers together. He's up for confirmation. What's going on?
So he had his hearing today. It looks like he will be confirmed eventually on a fairly party-line vote. Democrats are opposed to him because he represents pretty much the hard right Tea Party faction of the House Republican Conference. He's a big supporter of a big overhaul of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And in his hearing today, he was actually pressed on the differences in his position on those entitlements and President Trump, who promised not to cut any of them. And Mulvaney, fairly interesting answer, did not back off one bit from his position and said he would advise Trump pretty much to go back on his campaign promise because of how big a driver of the debt those programs are going to be in the coming years.
So he's part of a pattern then. There have been a number of appointees who have said during their confirmation hearings that they did not necessarily agree with the president-elect, the man who chose them.
Right. And they've all stressed pretty much the same thing. You know, they are going to give their advice to the president, and then it's the president who's going to make the decision. And so, you know, from Mick Mulvaney's testimony, it's not clear that President Trump has moved off his position on entitlements. But it's clear that he's going to face some pressure not only from Republicans in Congress, but from his own top budget advisor to do so. And that's going to be a huge fight with the Democrats if they pursue those plans.
So let me go back to our first guest, Alexander Bolton, a staff reporter for The Hill, who first told us about the skinny budget and the $10 billion they're going to save over 10 years. That's always, of course, a lot longer than Congress can do anything. 10 years is very long in this process, which seems to be to go forward on at least a year-by-year, session-by-session basis. Where does this appear to leave us at the moment? And how are the members of Congress responding to what they're hearing so far?
Warren, I just want to clarify something.
Yeah.
The budget they're putting, the preliminary budget they're working on right now in OMB is based on the Heritage Blueprint, which would save $10.5 billion over 10 years. And that Heritage Blueprint is also the foundation of the RSC budget, which the Republican Study Committee, majority of House Republicans, which their budget would save $8.5 trillion over 10 years. The Heritage would save $10.5 trillion over 10 years. So it remains to be seen whether the Trump budget will actually take that big a bite out of the deficit. That would depend on Trump actually signing off on Social Security and Medicare cuts. So, that's TBD. Now, what they are doing is they're using those budget plans as the basis to go after specific programs like National Endowment of the Arts, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, maybe Legal Services Corporation. I mean, those are the things that are in the mix, the things that the conservatives want to kill. Now,
small potatoes.
But even that is proving to be a fight within their own party. And what we're seeing, and I've talked to Republicans across the spectrum on Friday during the inauguration, and you had Roger Wicker. He was the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee in the last cycle. He's defending the USDA inspection of catfish aquaculture. I mean, that's something that's slated for elimination in the RSC, the Republican Study Committee budget, and the Heritage budget. That's something on the table right now at OMB for being cut. But Roger Wicker, I mean, he says, no, this is a very important program. We need to keep it. I mean, he's a Republican. Lisa Murkowski, she's the chairwoman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee here in the Senate. She's dead set against cutting the Essential Air Services program. That's something that is also in the Heritage budget. It's also in the Republican Study Committee budget that these transition officials, Russ Vogt and John Gray, are using as the basis of their conversations with people at OMB. She says that can't be cut. I will pull out all the stops to fight that. Don Young from Alaska, a longtime House Republican member of the Transportation Committee, he's also against getting rid of that. Even Orrin Hatch, and I was doing some research on Legal Services Corporation. Back when Reagan was trying to cut this program in the 80s, Hatch was one of the guys that was supporting getting rid of the Legal Services Corporation because he thought it was advocating liberal positions. Fast forward 30 years, I talked to him on Friday about it. He says, "Look, that's not going anywhere. We tried it. It's gonna stick around." So what you have right now is you have a clash between the idealistic revolutionaries who are coming into power with Trump, and these are guys who are basically riding on Mike Pence's coattails, okay? And Mike Pence is a committed conservative. He was a guy who was battling his own leadership for years over these very types of programs. Kind of unexpectedly, he is now in a position of power, and he has much more familiarity with the budget fights of yesteryear than Trump does. And he's kind of, it seems to me, he's taking the lead through his staff on that stuff. But he, just like 10 years ago when he was a chairman of the Republican Study Committee, when he was a soldier in the Republican Study Committee, he is once again fighting the more mainstream members of his party, like Roger Wicker of Tennessee. I'm sorry, Roger Wicker of Mississippi, like Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, like others who are saying, look, these various pet programs are actually very important for rural America, which is something that, we as Republicans represent.
So let me go back to Russell Berman with The Atlantic. We haven't even mentioned the fact that Trump wants to increase spending on the military. What did Mick Mulvaney, the prospective Office of Management and Budget, have to say about that?
Well, that was interesting. He said again that he would follow the president on that issue. He voiced no objections to increasing defense spending, despite the fact that he was not a he was more of a spending hawk and not a defense hawk when he was in the Congress, and technically he still is in the Congress. And that was a bit of concern for some of the Republicans who really do support increasing defense spending, the fact that Mulvaney had prioritized cutting spending overall, including in the military. But he was introduced in his hearing, interestingly enough, by two senators who are defense hawks, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, where Mulvaney is from, and Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. And so that was sort of a signal to the defense hawks in the Senate that they can trust Mulvaney, that he's not going to fight Trump and the defense hawks on that issue.
So let me go back to Jared Bernstein. Again, you worked for Vice President Biden. What are the hawks when it comes to cutting the budget running up against the fact that the government simply, like it or not, does things that people need and want to have done?
No question about it. And our friend from the Hill can confirm this, but I remember that this RSC budget, the Republican Study Group budget that he was just talking about, I think that that came up for a vote, and I think it lost in the Republican Congress. So that just underscores the point that when you actually get down to people and programs, all this high-flying kind of ideological, the government doesn't do anything right, the government must be cut every which way, it's totally inefficient, that's all just rhetoric. And this is ultimately, I mean, I'm glad we're talking about this because I think it's important to reveal, this is a pretty meaningless discussion. None of this stuff is going to happen. I want to make one other point. One reason we're in the mess that we're in terms of looking at these budget problems down the road has to do with tax cuts. Remember, part of the budgets that we're talking about don't just go after spending. They also significantly cut the revenues coming into the Treasury, whether it's getting rid of the Affordable Care Act and the taxes that support that, or just straight up tax cuts as proposed by Donald Trump or House Republicans. That adds multiple trillions to the budget pressures that we're discussing. So we can't leave that out of the mix. And when Republicans decided some number of years ago that any new revenues were completely off the table in terms of negotiations, they began to put themselves in the kind of box that we're talking about now.
Let me go back to Peter Maurizi. It's been argued for many, many years that if you make tax cuts at the very top, then the prosperity at the top will trickle down and everybody will be better off. That's been debated for a long, long time, certainly since the Reagan administration. Now we have a situation in Kansas where that is exactly what they have done. And Kansas is in terrible, terrible shape. Is this an idea whose time has long passed?
I like the way you phrase that question. Do you still beat your wife? A couple of things to recognize is that the states have much more less latitude to cut taxes and create incentives. The majority of income taxes that companies pay or individuals pay is imposed by the federal government. So if you're talking about cutting a meaningful amount of taxes to change incentives, then it has to come through the personal and corporate taxes administered by the federal government. I don't want to go off on a tangent, but why states do well and don't do well often doesn't have a lot to do with their level of taxation.
Well, what about the federal government then? And all this is these issues we've been talking about.
All right. Okay, that's fair enough. Ronald Reagan managed to accomplish better than 4% growth by cutting taxes and deregulating, and that is the basic strategy here. Now, over the past decades since Reagan, we've had a tendency for Republican administrations to cut taxes on for everybody and for Democratic administrations to raise them on higher income individuals. So we've gotten to the point that 84% of the taxes is paid by 20% of the population, the top 20% of earners. They are now paying very, very high taxes, and one can argue that this is a disincentive to small business formation and investment and things of that nature. I think you can get some punch out of flattening the tax structure. Jared doesn't. I do. I do admit that there's limits to that punch. Likewise, you can get some punch out of streamlining regulations. They've become terribly burdensome over the last 8 years. If you do the two together, I think one and one will equal three. That's what I believe. I think you'll then get a lot of punch for growth.
Quickly, Jared Bernstein, California is suffering because it depends to such an extent on the revenue it gets from high earners that when the stock market goes down, the revenue goes down and there are no programs, and programs have to be cut. Is the federal government heading in that same direction?
It's already gotten there. In other words, our fiscal accounts are, as I said in my last comment, our fiscal accounts are under tremendous pressure because of the cuts that we've taken to the tax system that have never been at all replaced by Democrats.
So what about flattening the tax structure then and streamlining regulations?
Again, this is kind of the trickle-down deregulation agenda that worked horribly for George W. Bush. You can definitely point to Ronald Reagan. Those were good growth years for GDP and jobs. But then look at Bill Clinton, raised taxes, increased regulation, and he had an equally good growth outlook. Look, what happens when you cut taxes and deregulate is you're just exacerbating inequality, which is already embedded it in the economy anyway. You're making the wealthy even richer after tax than they were before, and you're inviting the kinds of reckless investment behavior that got us into the mess with the housing bubble or the dot-com bubble or any other bubble you want. It's easy to wave your hands and say, I'm against regulation, but when you actually get down, it's almost like the spending discussion. When you actually get down to specifics, you can get yourself into trouble pretty quickly.
Okay, so Russell Berman, I got back to you with The Atlantic, covering national politics. Obviously, these are major issues, and some of the questions simply cannot be resolved, certainly not on this program. What do you anticipate now as the Trump administration goes forward? Speaker Ryan has asked the president to come and address a joint session of Congress. He will no doubt do that. Where is he going to go, given the kinds of problems he's already encountering less than a week into his first administration?
Well, I think it's going to be I think it's unclear, because the Republicans really want to pursue this agenda that, as Alex pointed out, they've been laying the groundwork for a number of years. But Trump, in his inaugural address, laid out a much more populist agenda. You mentioned the infrastructure proposal. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how Trump words his address to Congress in a month, because is he going to ask them for $1 trillion for infrastructure, or is he going to really accede to their wishes for a much more conservative, a much smaller government agenda? And we just don't know, and I think that's because I think the president himself has not confronted those questions. So far, it's only his advisors who have really been looking at this, as opposed to Trump himself.
And as we heard, he's got to reconcile things with his own party first.
Right. And you know, the Republicans in Congress are going on their annual retreat this week to Philadelphia. We hope to have some more of an idea of what their agenda is going to be after that meeting. And Trump is going to be speaking at that conference, as is Vice President Pence. And so we may have a better indication come Friday morning as to what the first 100 days or the next 95 days are going to look like in the Trump administration.
All right. City of brotherly love. We'll see what comes out of that. Russell Berman with The Atlantic, many thanks to you. Thanks to Peter Morici with the Robert H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. Jared Bernstein with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, formerly with the Obama administration. Alexander Bolton, staff reporter for The Hill. Great to have you all, and many thanks. In a moment, President Trump and the White House Press Corps on To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Allen here with today's talking point. On Saturday, President Trump started to make nice at CIA headquarters, but he quickly turned to insulting the news media as among the most dishonest human beings on Earth. Press Secretary Sean Spicer followed up with a bitter attack of his own, but then yesterday, at his first official White House news briefing, Spicer gave a kinder, gentler account of his position.
It's about sitting here every time and being told, no, well, we don't think he can do that. He'll never accomplish that. He can't win that. It won't be the biggest. It's not going to be that good. The crowds aren't that big. He's not that successful. The narrative and the default narrative is always negative. And it's demoralizing.
Okay, demoralizing. Jay Rosen is a media critic. He's a writer as well as a professor of journalism at New York University. Jay Rosen, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Should the White House Press Corps in particular be sympathetic to a White House press secretary who finds all these questions demoralizing?
No, I don't think they should be sympathetic at all. He chose to work for a man who is easily wounded by numbers like ratings and vote totals and numbers of people at his inauguration. And there's no reason why they should cater to the narcissistic wounds of a leader who needs everyone to lie for him.
Well, now, speaking of lying for him, we have all of these issues about contrary facts that have been brought up by various people in the Trump campaign. Apparently today, there was a long back and forth between the reporters and Sean Spicer, the press secretary, who was asked multiple times about Trump's claims that he, in fact, lost the election because of all of the illegal voting that went on amongst undocumented immigrants in particular. And he was asked again and again, was that going to be investigated, or was it simply a totally false claim? What do you think of that conversation, if you will? I know you may not have heard it, neither did I, but that's what happened.
Well, the claim was not that he lost the election, but that he lost the popular vote.
The popular vote, excuse me.
Yeah, popular vote because of the votes of illegal immigrants. There is no good evidence for that. It has been studied a lot. And so what that exchange is really about is the White House reserves the right, in the words of the president and also in the briefing room, to simply dispense with conventional notions of evidence, just as the whole idea of fake news was redefined into meaninglessness by calling questionable stories on CNN or the New York Times fake news. The whole idea of evidence-based claims is under attack. So it's not just a lie here, a distortion there. Goal here is to erode the common world of fact that people can disagree about and instead drive disagreement deeper into what is a fact and is there really any such thing as evidence, and you have your facts and we have our alternative facts. That's the world they want to live in, and the briefing room is kind of a theater for the emergence of that world.
What does that goal give them if in fact they're able to achieve it?
I think what it gives them is this, Warren. For their core supporters, it gives them people to root for and root against. And, of course, the press as hate object is what they can root against. For the core doubters of Trump, his opponents, it gives them something to obsess about and scream about and argue about. And that noise sort of helps distract them from more fundamental things. And then for the people in the middle who are not opponents or supporters, it sends the message that this is all too confusing. Who knows who's right? It's not worth paying attention. So just go back and live your life and don't bother too much with this messy politics.
We have any models for this? Anybody else ever tried this?
Sure. The models are in authoritarian regimes where it became impossible to figure out what's going on. Whether it's Latin America, like in Argentina decades ago, or Turkey today, or Poland today, or Hungary, that's where you have the models. And that's one of the things that our journalists need to do is they need to start looking at the crumbling of tenuous democracy in other countries where authoritarian regimes have replaced a nominally democratic system. That would help a lot.
It's been reported that over the weekend, when Sean Spicer, the press secretary, announced that he was going to make a statement, CNN didn't cover it live, but rather assessed it before putting it on the air. Is that something you think that could become a pattern with other news organizations, or are they so competitive they're all going to want to get something on the air live in order to beat everybody else?
Well, competition in news has a strange meaning. It means everybody does the same thing, but call themselves competitors, which is kind of the opposite of what the valorization of competition is supposed to mean. But I think in that case, CNN did make an independent decision. It was smart of them to do that. And that's what we need more of. We need news organizations that are willing to break from the pack, exercise their own judgment, anticipate that something could be deeply misleading, and act with a kind of radical skepticism that maybe they wouldn't have under previous presidents, Democratic and Republican. So anything that shows a newsroom making up its own mind as opposed to going with the flow or common practice is, from my point of view, good.
You have suggested that rather than sending star reporters to the White House briefings, the major news organizations ought to send interns.
Yes. And the reason I said that is I think the White House briefing room is going to become a theater of distortion. It's going to try and turn reporters into hate objects, as I've said. Misstatements, falsehoods, and flat-out lies are going to be defended by the press secretary if the president believes them. And rather than wait around to be hate objects in that setting, I think they ought to send their least experienced people so that their most experienced and talented people can move to outside in rather than inside out reporting. And also sending the JV team, as it were, would also send a message to the Trump White House, is this is what you've done to the briefing room. You've made it into such a comic spectacle of untruths that we can't even send our regular people anymore. There's no point.
Isn't it true, though, that to some extent, every presidency has tried to manipulate the press corps, the images that were put forth and the news stories that were reported, to the extent that it could? Is this just a more exaggerated form of doing the same old thing?
It is absolutely true that every presidency, including the Obama presidency, practiced the art of spin, would try, if they could, to mislead the press, would make claims that had to be subjected to doubt. But journalists in that world assumed that when something was proven to be certifiably false, when overwhelming evidence came out to make it an untrue statement, that was a problem not only for them, not only for the press corps, but for the White House. And the White House would have to take responsibility for that. Scott McClellan under George W. Bush actually resigned when it became clear that something he had said from the White House lectern was false. And so that is what's different, is the Trump crowd, Trump himself, and the people who work for him, they don't care if what they are shown to be saying is false. And they actually see advantages in being successfully fact-checked by the press corps that works for them.
Okay. I'm sorry to say we got to cut this off. Fascinating conversation. Jay Rosen at New York University. Many thanks.
Thanks, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.